first minute or two, the sound is a little raw, but it gets cleared up real fast. So don't worry about the initial sound quality. John Steele on Emory, KPFK Los Angeles.
Okay, we have ignition. This morning, we're going to explore a vast array of stuff which has come to me over the years through various channels and with no names. And I'm really going to speak my mind. I'm going to think it out so it's not in any set form, but there is an order I want to go through. And it will be kind of a look at different elements of contracted mind and extended mind, so we can begin to see the juxtaposition of the two, how each one defines the other. The element of contracted mind I'd like to look at first before the extended mind aspect. And for those of you who heard me last, I'll briefly capitulate this idea of the Kali Yuga as a set piece before I launch into the specifics. The Kali Yuga is the age that we live in terms of East Indian chronology. There are four great yugas of time. There is, roughly speaking, a golden age, a Sat Yuga, and then a silver age, and then a bronze age, and then an iron age, each one of varying durations. We won't get into the cosmological mathematics because they're up for grabs. Allegedly, the age that we live in now is the end of a cycle. Each of these four ages is part of a cycle called a Maha Yuga. The Kali Yuga is the Dark Age, it's the Iron Age, it's the age of Kali. Kali is a goddess of dissolution of time and structures. She clears the way for those impediments of evolution that have arisen. Now, in the Kali Yuga, what occurs is, in terms of time, very interesting, because the Tibetan translation for Kali Yuga literally means the dregs of time. The dregs of time, what does that mean? It means the bottom of the barrel of time. It means that time has reached a density, a certain temporal density, and this temporal density can actually be felt somatically in the body. Now, what is the definition of temporal density? Temporal density means we have too many events per unit of time to fully assimilate in our everyday life. That means that you've got to pay the bills and take the kids out and go to the doctor and wash the clothes and put out the cat and, you know, do everything. It's an unending array of tasks that have to be accomplished. And just when you think you've finished them all, new ones magically arise. You are never finished. Now, so the Kali Yuga has this this idea of a temporal density, and I want to explore that in several different ways here. One of the things that occurs in the Kali Yuga, one other aspect, which is an interesting concomitant to the temporal density, is that there is a seasonal disequilibrium. In other words, the climate and the seasons go out of whack. Rain doesn't fall at the right time. Snow doesn't fall at the time. There's a seasonal imbalance. This is one of the aspects in terms of the Kali Yuga, this climatic And what I'm pointing to is when you get a temporal high temporal density, there is at least a correspondence to a climatic fluctuation. And as people like Padmasambhava and other great teachers have said, this climatic disequilibrium is part of the Kali Yuga. Now, one of the aspects in terms of, again, of Eastern thought that occurs in the Kali Yuga our time window narrows in this kind of density scenario. And so, since last night the Miller Lite beer ad was mentioned, I will mention another beer ad which may bring back some memories. Quite a few years ago in America, there was a Schlitz ad, Schlitz beer of Milwaukee, and it showed these macho guys on the sailboat, and they'd be coming out, and it said, "You only go around once in life, so grab all the gusto you can." So the idea was, since, you know, this was it, you had as time as possible right now. So the idea encapsulated in this ad is many different values. First of all is the idea that there are no past lives and there are no future lives. This is it. And therefore, you've got to hedonistically explode in the moment and just really grab everything possible. Now, the value inherent here is that you'll go for short-term games and to hell with anything possible long-term. So this means rip off anyone, have war, as long as you profit in the immediate moment. Grab all the gusto you can. Now, back to Buddhism for a moment. In the one of the sutras, the La Kāvantara Sutra, one of the Buddhist sutras, there is a wonderful teaching, and it is not Tantric Buddhism, it's Mahayana Buddhism, but it's still the same basic set. And one of the teachings in there goes as such, for those of you who, my work is on memory, so I have this great interest in the subject. It says, when the triple world is surveyed, that's past, present, future, by the Bodhisattva, he perceives that its existence is due to memory that has been accumulated since the beginningless past, but wrongly interpreted. Now, it is this concept of memory that is wrongly interpreted that I want to take a good hard look at here. And before we get into that, a few more notes here. The word memory in Sanskrit comes from the word vasana, V-A-S-A-N-A, and it's a beautiful word because it has several different nuances. It means a memory which is transmitted from one life to another, either consciously or unconsciously, usually unconsciously. Memories, habit patterns that are generated within one life are called samskaras. That's different from a vasana. Vasanas have a cross-life connection. Now, one of the secondary meanings of this word vasana is very appropriate to one of my other interests, and that is fragrance, because the secondary meaning of the word vasana means if you have an empty perfume bottle, even if it's completely empty, the smell always remains of that scent in that bottle. In other words, the scent pervades even when the vessel is empty, and this is what in the Sanskrit language, very mixture of great technical precision and great poetic insight. You have this idea that a past life memory is like it's like the smell which goes through time. The smell memory goes from one life to another, even though the bottle is empty. Now, this word also means habit energy. Vasana means habit energy, and this word habit energy in Tibetan, bakchak is the term for it. It's like a trace, like the smell, like the trace. And the teaching in the sutra is that these traces, they build up after a while to the extent where we begin to nucleate an ego around them, like I get up every morning and I do this and I eat that. And you get this whole kind of an axis of a moment, what the Buddhists call an axis of the moment begins to generate. This I, the subject, begins to generate from habitual action, repetitive, automatic, hypnotic, action. Now, therefore, one of the ways, one of the strategies to deal with this nucleation around this moment of subjectivity is to learn how to, shall we say, die to oneself. And this is in the perennial philosophy and the mystical philosophies known as the tradition of unknowing, like the 14th century English mystic work, The Cloud of Unknowing. And this whole process I want to look at in a moment. I just wanted to set that out. Now, with the idea of memory wrongly interpreted, we can begin to look at a bit of present time through this filter. You see, we live in an age at which we are virtually hoarding memory. Computers are based on the idea, like you look at women in terms of their vital measurements. Well, you look at computers in terms of their vital measurements, in terms of their memory capacities. This one has so many bits, and this one has more bits, and this one can process those bits faster and faster. The memorial capacity is really the key to the strength of a computer. Now, the trouble is with this is that I'm generalizing. Much of what computers do is wonderful. I'm not putting down computers per se. But there is an emphasis on the acquisition of memories that can be stuck into the computer. And what two memories do after a while, whether they are in a... See, because if they're in a computer, even if they're in a computer, they have to be in a programmer's mind, even in a real chunked style. There have to be some level of recursiveness in the programmer's mind. Now, how much he offloads into the computer itself, there has to be some level of memory of what's inside. So the more that's inside the computer, the more that has to be in the mind of the programmer. It's a great reduction, but still, you begin to set up a great array of memories that is auxiliary to what would be good for ordinary life. Now, what begins to happen is that with this tremendous array of memory storage, and we have, you begin to clog a system. A system becomes constipated by actual too much hoarding of memory. Now, this hoarding of memory sets up a kind of a psychological density. And as a system becomes clogged, it becomes brittle. That is to say, it cannot react quickly to crisis situations because it is overloaded with choices and information. There's too much information. Every time that something happens now in the modern world, the reaction time is stunted to such a point by the vast array of information processing technology that people cannot react like that anymore in real critical decisions. Everything is so rationally displayed in terms of its memorial capacity. And yet, with all this memorial capacity and all this incredible telecommunications, the world is coming apart at the seams. I mean, we're balanced, as the Tibetans say, we're licking honey from the razor's edge in terms of our information acquisition. It's actually memory wrongly interpreted, this vast collection of memory, as though more is better. That's the assumption we're working under. Now, the more memory that you accrete, you see, paradoxically, you set yourself up more for what in systems terms we call the likelihood of a run. A runaway system is like a snowball going down a hill, getting bigger and bigger and more progressively out of control. And the more you develop memory wrongly interpreted in terms of vast acquisition, the more likely you are to go into a runaway system. Because your reaction time is cut. Your direct perception, your direct, unmediated by vast information technology is cut. And this likelihood of a runaway system occurs. And this is what happens, you see, in things like all this Contragate stuff. You have this incredible information technology. You have the NSC computers and the CIA computers and the DIA computers and all these things. And what happens is that you lose control of who's in charge. It's Ollie North is running the ball this way, and Colby is running the ball this way, and everyone's kind of what we call in systems theories again. You begin to generate institutions within institutions. And this happens when you get this memory wrongly interpreted to such a point where clarity disappears of the overview. Now, what further begins to happen is that this memory wrongly interpreted begins to generate. There are two types of unconscious mind I want to point out here. One is what I would call unconscious. And that's when you're asleep at the wheel. It's like you're dead drunk. It's like you're numbed. There's no sensation. Okay, that's unconscious. Then, contrasted to that, there's conscious unconscious. Now, the link of conscious-unconscious is really shamanic consciousness. It's where there is a bridge between the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. It's what Jung would call the transcendent function. There is a bridge between these two realms. Now, most people are walking around, as all the perennial philosophies say, we're in a state of sleep. We're walking around in a state of unconscious. It's what Gurdjieff calls, we're all asleep. We're sleepwalkers. This unconscious, what happens then is this: there's an unconscious mental mass is generated by memory wrongly interpreted. In other words, what begins to happen is, conversely to what Terence was talking about last night, the idea of a living conscious memory, what gets generated is what William Burroughs would call language as virus is generated. You see, this is where language goes out of control. It's just the opposite to a living language. And what is what I call an unconscious mental mass proliferates in the environment. And it means that there's all these kind of invisible habit patterns and invisible kind of runaway systems linguistically on a subvocal voice in the environment. And one of my teachers has said that at a certain point, habit patterns become solidified in the environment and in the body. Now, this is something that, and this is from the Tibetan point of view, this is something actually that Norbu said, that habit patterns get solidified, and the great illustration of this in terms of, for example, tantric thought, is there's a great Indian Mahasiddha, Saraha, who was the arrow maker. And he taught the idea that memory, it can exist in many states. It's like water. Water can be very fluid, and that at a certain point it can become ice and become solidified. That's the shift from natural mind and natural memory to memory wrongly interpreted when it solidifies. And when it solidifies, the mind stops, it gels like that. And that's where this sensation ego comes from, this nucleation. So this idea of an unconscious mental mass as the idea of language as virus is something that we kind of have to be aware of. It's the idea that words have a life of their own. It's like people's minds, the subvocal voice. Oftentimes you think, well, I'm in charge, and the subvocal voice is going, I want this, I want this, I want this, what the Buddhists call monkey mind. It's like it's going here and here and here, and you are saying, I don't really think that, but something else, this automatic mind is going off, and that's this language as virus, memory wrongly interpreted, gone organic. Now, one of the aspects of why that there's this great accumulation of memory is it's the idea, the illusion is that the more memory we have, the more control and manipulation and prediction of reality we will have if we can manage memory and keep it, you know, on tap so we can push a button. Therefore, we'd be able to manipulate reality better with all this memory that we've got there, and the external forms of computer banks and books and everything else. And we begin to hoard memory because we feel it will give us prediction and control and manipulation of reality. The Central Intelligence Agency, stop and think of that for a moment. Central Intelligence Agency, what does it do? It gathers information about everything in the world except the natural intelligence of the people who are in the organization. There's nothing to do with self-knowledge. Intelligence of the other, not of self-knowledge. Now, the idea of this memory wrongly interpreted brings us to an interesting model here. Again, in the Buddhist framework, we talk about that thought or memory, as the teaching goes, as Saraha teaches in his what he calls the Song, the Dohas. And these are kind of like poetic teachings. He teaches that memory arises from emptiness, abides in emptiness, and then dissolves back into emptiness. Or, as he teaches, memory arises from non-memory, what he calls non-memory, abides in non-memory, and then sinks back, dissolves into non-memory. Now, this cycle of arising, abiding, and dissolving is the cycle of all thought. And this cycle is also two other analogs that we can give to it. It is the basic nature of today what Prigogine calls dissipative systems. Things arise, they abide, and they dissolve. And they arise in a slightly different form, and then they abide in a slightly different form, and they dissolve. Now, dissipative systems, a footnote on this, is much more ancient than Prigogine. What all he's done is brought it into a contemporary mode. In the early forms of my interest of archaeology, we find it embodied in the idea of the triple goddess. That is to say, the triple goddess is exemplified by the three phases of moon. And that is to say, there's a new moon, there's a full moon, and then there's the waning moon. And then they go back to a fourth phase, which people rarely really recognize, and that is the state where moon is not visible at all. That is really the true emptiness. And this dissipative cycle is mirrored in the arising of thought, abiding of thought, and dissolving back into. Now, well, the reason I bring this up is the following, is that in the paradigm of memory, as it's looked at in the 20th century, memory is looked at primarily from the point of view of Western psychology only in one of these three phases. That is to say, it's looked at principally in the middle phase, the abiding phase. We do not look at where memory comes from or where it goes to. Only in a psychoanalytical sense, we look at your childhood memories and stuff like that. But we do not really consider the idea of emptiness or of non-memory as an origin point. We look at this kind of psychoanalytic history as our way, but not as real emptiness. So we have a focus only on one phase, the abiding phase, that is the phase of how do memories operate in the ordinary, everyday, visible world. How do we operate in that form? And this is where memory, wrongly interpreted, generates itself and proliferates, right in this, only looking at the middle phase of the dissipative cycle. Because you neglect the arising and dissolving, you begin to get an overbalance, and that's why it gets brittle, that's why it gets constipated, because you looked at and only one part of it. Okay, now the next thing that I would like to look at is the idea that one of the characteristics of the Kali Yuga, another one besides this temporal density, is the whole concept, and this is something I've been developing from my doctoral thesis for years, but it progressively comes into more focus, is the idea of object proliferation. Object proliferation. Now, let me give you a brief history of objects to put you in the picture. The first man-made objects that we have are 3 million years old. These first objects are found in Africa, and they are very small. They are like hand axes and pounding tools and things like that, with a minimal of modification to them, very minimally modified. And as an archaeologist, I happen to study this in great detail, the kind of generation of tool making. And what progressively begins to happen after another 1.5 million years of no new and improved models. Can you imagine, you know, the car industry with the same models for 1.5 million years? What begins to happen, the first innovation is symmetry. That's the first innovation in tool making, is the idea of some degree of symmetry. And then you begin to get into chipping and flaking and sharpening, and gradually you finally get into what we call microgeometry tools. You get into very, very small tools that are very precise and the kind of needlepoint stuff and very, very finely made things about 30,000, 40,000 years ago. And it's about 30,000 or 40,000 years ago, again, where you begin to generate the first symbolic objects. That's where you go from functional to symbolic objects. And when you make this leap, language is, you know, afoot as soon as you begin to get symbolic objects. And with symbolic objects and language, everything begins to escalate. Because in the scenario of objects, as it were, what begins to happen is roughly we have the Neolithic Revolution, which is about 9,000-10,000 BC. Some people put it a few thousand years earlier or later, but it's irrelevant. In the Neolithic Revolution, essentially, before we were hunter-gatherers, we were nomads. We followed herds of different animals, the caribou and the deer and the bison and the mammoth. We followed the seasonal growth of plants to wherever they occurred. We followed nature, and we did not own nature. Now, what gradually began to happen in the Neolithic Revolution, someone had a bright idea, and that is that we could domesticate crops and animals. We did not have to follow. We could take something and plant it. And with this planting, we could stay in one place. We would not be at the kind of whims of this grand seasonal variation. And our animals, we could domesticate animals. That is to say, we did not have to go hunting all the time. We would begin to domesticate cows and keep in pens, and sheep and goats and things like that would begin to occur. And, you know, it's a wonderful invention for many people, the idea of stopping this nomadic life. Others were not so sure that this was a great idea, because there was a great virtue in the nomadic life in many ways as well. But history rolled on, and what began to happen is, as you begin to settle and to nucleate, you began to generate objects this time in a different scale than just hand axes and cutting tools, just the bare essential tools. You began to make tools, more permanent holding tools now. Instead of transporting water in ostrich eggs that were biodegradable in a very neat sense, you would begin to make longer lasting objects of clays and potteries. And in other words, the half-life of your objects would begin to increase. The idea of permanent objects instead of kind of a throwaway culture began to accrete. And as these objects began to accrete, you began to gradually through the earth make decorations on them and art on the objects. And this made the objects more valuable, quote, whatever that meant at the time. And these objects had the very strange effect on people's minds as they act like an attractor matrix for the human mind on which to see even further possibilities for the proliferation of even more objects. That is to say, once you made a bowl, well, we can make a better bowl, and a bowl with a spout, and then a bowl with a this on it, and with greater capacity, and then so on and so forth. Object proliferation began to form. It began to be a mirror to which the mind could say, well, we've done this, but we can do this better. Before, you extracted from nature. Now you were on this kind of reflection process. So that was one dynamic that began to occur, object proliferation and the generation of even more objects. Now, I should say at a footnote right now, before I go on with the scenario, the average home has in it today 300,000 objects in it. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. And that means that you have to deal with the idea, the location and function and care of all these objects. So therefore, a lot of your mental activity is tied into this object array environment. Okay? Now, what happens, let's go back to the Neolithic for a moment. You see, then we have very few objects. It's gone from a few pots and bowls and a few digging sticks and spears and what have you and furs and beads and things like that to 300,000. I mean, the proliferation that has to go with that. You see, the concomitant proliferation is the secret of this process. Is when you begin to generate objects, you have to have a concomitant corresponding memory for every object that you own, whether it's online or not. It is. The point is that we don't keep the 300,000 memory online all the time. It's we chunk things. We say it's in the garage, it's in the bedroom, it's in the den, it's in the kitchen. We have a chunking by spatial kind of labeling. But on the whole, what happens is as soon as you have an object, you have to have a memory of that object. Otherwise, the object is useless to you. You don't know where you put it, and therefore you can't use it. So you have to have some corresponding memory. Now, in terms of ship, what begins to happen is very interesting. As soon as you begin to have this object proliferation, you begin to have the generation of a noun. A linguistic noun has to come into being for the generation of that object. This is a spear thrower. This is, you know, my water bowl. This is my fur to keep me warm. This is my talisman, whatever it is. You have a corresponding noun for every object that is generated. Now, with this kind of generation of noun, the converse of this, most curious thing begins to happen is the generation of pronouns. N begins to occur. This is my object. This is your object. This is his object. This is their object. When you were in nature, there's no pronouns. There was just this vast, undifferentiated participation mystique. No differentiation of subject and object. Therefore, no pronoun. So pronouns are generated from nouns. And nouns are generated from objects. So you get this linguistic matrix beginning to occur. And it occurs in this kind of unconscious proliferation. Again, language is virus. Now, what begins to happen is, again, the possibility of runaway systems. As Morris Berman, a cultural historian, pointed out recently, you begin to get what he calls commodity fetishism. The idea that in the old days when objects, for example, certain totemic things in the Indian Northwest were made, they were meant to degenerate with weather after they were made. The masks and the things like that were left and disintegrate, to dissolve in the dissipative cycle back into nature. They rise, they abided, and they dissolved. They were not kept as objects of art, you see. What we have done is taken these objects and got into the abiding phase, memory wrongly interpreted, and we fixate there, and we keep that going. So you get this very kind of interesting scenario arising. Now, let's take a look at this in terms of the media, how this can be put to us in a very entertaining and insightful way. There was a film that was made, I don't know, maybe 7-8 years ago. Something, I don't know, maybe it was more than that, 10 years ago. Called The Gods Must Be Crazy. How many of you saw this film? I figured a lot of you would. I'll give you a brief recapitulation of this film because it's a wonderful teaching film. Basically, the scenario happens, there's an airplane flying over Africa, and two of the guys in it, one of them is drinking Coca-Cola, and he finishes the bottle, and he throws it out of the plane. They're over the middle of nowhere. He throws it out, and it lands near a Bushman hunting party, as chance would have. And the Bushmen then see this bottle, and it is the introduction of a new and novel object into the culture. when this object comes in, first it is met with wonder and awe, and the multifarious uses of it are then discovered. First of all, you could put things in it as a container that was very durable. It was a wonderful container for water. Second of all, you could roll things out like a roller. Then you could blow in it and make wonderful sounds with it. Then you could, you know, all these objects were all these uses for the object were seen. But what began to happen is that everyone wanted to use it. All the pronoun thing began to arise as soon as this object was introduced. And what began to happen in this little world where there was peace and harmony was discord. Tremendous sense of discord. I want it, no. And fights began to break out over who was going to use this Coca-Cola bottle.
Squabbling.
Exactly.
This Coca-Cola.
This Coca-Cola had occurred. So the thought was, and this is brilliant, the Bushman wisdom thought, the gods must be crazy to have given us this object. It causes havoc in this society. So one of them was given the task to take this Coca-Cola bottle to the edge of the world and get rid of it. Get this object out of here. We got enough objects. That's essentially what they were saying. Okay, so in a microcosm in this film is this wonderful teaching about how an object, a single object in this case, can take a harmonically based culture and throw it out the window. Jung said, speaking of our current era, knowledge of the internal psyche was eclipsed by the external world of objects. The very same insight. The more we got hooked objects, the more that we began to lose the kind of internal world. Now, it's interesting that in terms of the very first writing ever discovered is a favorite kind of point that's come up archaeologically. It's not some mystical writing about Mu or Lemuria or channeling or anything like that. The first writing ever discovered is a Sumerian tax receipt. It's 4500 BC, and it's a tax receipt. Because what it is saying is, you have dealt with these objects, and we want to keep a record of them so that we can find out the karmic trajectory of this object. Now, what begins to happen is record-keeping grows as an industry. For all, you have to keep a memory for every object. Record-keeping grows in proportion to object proliferation. Today, the biggest industry on the face of the earth is record-keeping. That's what computers do more than anything else, besides their creative uses. They do more than anything else is inventory. It's record-keeping. And they're doing it. They're keeping track of objects and events connected with objects. The transactions and interactions and transformations of objects, that's what is being kept records of. So record keeping grows out of this proliferation of this object array. So in a sense, you see, you get an extended mind, an unconscious extended mind is generated through this generation of objects. And what it begins to generate then is the idea of shall we say, a left-brain memory. Now, a left-brain memory, you see, corresponds to the middle phase of the dissipative cycle. That is to say, the abiding phase of memory. Memory in the world that we can see. And this, again, is the realm where, if you overload it, memory wrongly interpreted begins to proliferate. Now, let's take a little bit, a closer look at this idea of the kind of the metaphysical arising of the way that we see the world. The density of objects, the density in an environment, creates a corresponding density of memory that you through record keeping. And in turn, this density of memory generates the density of time. Temporal density is a function of memorial density. And memorial density is a function of object density. You will notice that those cultures that have the fewest objects live in the dream time. You look at the Australian Aborigines, their minimal object array, and you see that they live in a completely different time frame. They live in a dream time, the Bushmen, the same. As your object density, memorial density, temporal density occurs, it sets out this extended unconscious array of time. Time is generated. And generation of time, the density of time, has a further aspect to it, which is very interesting. Because of the transactions and accounting for all these objects, the emphasis is placed on short-term memory, because there are more objects and more transactions and interactions. Therefore, the short-term memory, where did I put this and what did I do with this and what happened here, because there are more things, your short-term memory has to be more active. Your short-term memory has to be more active also in terms of crisis situations. Whenever you have a potential crisis going on, which is now pretty much nonstop in the world at large. So,